am pleased to return to my listeners at Campus FM with a new program in the series A Book, A Thousand Stories. This time, I review John Suchet's The Last Waltz. This program is enriched with beautiful music selected by Gerald Fennec. The script is mine, Patricia Salomone. John Suchet is well known to the listeners of Campus FM. He is the journalist and music expert who so ably runs classic music programs on Classic FM, especially the flagship morning program, daily from 9 a.m. In 2001, John Suchet was awarded honorary fellowship of the Royal Academy of Music in recognition of his writings on the life and work of Beethoven. In this series, I shall be reviewing Suchet's book, The Last Waltz, a study on the prolific music careers of the Strauss family. Johann Strauss Sr. and his three sons, a genial musical family so deeply disturbed that one wonders on how these people could have produced the carefree music that has been described as music that makes you happy. For the book itself, the hardback book entitled John Suchet, The Last Waltz, The Strauss Dynasty and Vienna, I must say that it is a state-of-the-art publication, a bonus for all book lovers to touch, to read, and to proudly display on their bookshelves. In order to embark on this review, let's go back to the first decade of the 20th century. It is September 1907, when Eduard Strauss, the youngest and last surviving son of Johann Strauss Sr., makes inquiries of oven manufacturers and incinerator plants in Vienna. He wants to know if they would incinerate several hundred kilos of waste paper. One factory owner in the Mariahelf district of Vienna agrees to take on the job, but he is shocked when a furniture van crammed full of bundles of paper arrives at his plant. Looking more closely at the hundreds, possibly thousands of pages, he knows he is looking at the compositions of the Strauss family. He decides to wait until Eduard arrives. Much though the man tries to dissuade Eduard from destroying all the material, he is adamant, and for 5 long hours he sits in an armchair, watching as the factory hands feed sheets and sheets of music manuscript, paper, librettos, personal correspondence, and documents to the flames. Not content with the day's destruction, it is said that Edward had 2 further truckloads of paper incinerated in another factory in the Porzellangasse. Why? What had prompted this seemingly senseless and cruel act? Was it the disappointment caused by his wasteful sons? Was it envy for the fame of his elder brothers and famous father? Was the now elderly, ailing Edward resentful and bitter at the passage of time and the changing music tastes? He is relentless. He has catalogued all the material. He knows full well that he is sending precious material up in smoke, depriving the world of who knows what great compositions, as well as valuable material relating to this most prodigious of musical families, lost in those few dire days of 1907. But let us go back to the beginning of John Souchez's book. In the introduction, the author tells us, "This book tells the extraordinary story of the most prolific and popular family of composers in musical history, and of the turbulent city in which they lived." The turbulent city is, of course, Vienna. Souchez goes on to call chapter 1, City of Dreams. So, a turbulent city of dreams. A city epitomized by contradictions, in which during the 19th century, fewer than half of those living in Vienna were Viennese by birth. Souchez tells us, a traveller in the early part of the 19th century reported, "Here you can meet the Hungarian striding swiftly with his close-fitting trousers and his long pigtail, or the round-headed Pole with his monkish hairstyle and flowing sleeves. Armenians, Romanians and Moldovians with their half-Oriental costumes. Serbians with their twisted moustache occupy a whole street. The Greeks smoking their long-stemmed pipes in the coffee houses. Bearded Muslims in yellow mules with their broad, murderous knives at their belts. Polish Jews all swathed in black, their hair all twisted in knots. Bohemian peasants with their long boots. Hungarian and Transylvanian wagoners with their sheepskin great coats. Croats with black tubs on their heads. All provide entertaining accents in the general throng." As for the languages spoken, the native languages of the Austrian Empire were German, Latin, French, Italian, Hungarian, Bohemian, Polish, Flemish, Greek, Turkish, Illyrian, Croatian, Slavic, Romanian, Romani. Yet, of all the exotica that travelers brought with them, none embedded itself more in the culture than music. Because, says Suchet, of all the arts, music is the most accessible and influential. But also because, in the dying decade of the 18th century, Vienna was too close to the revolution in Paris, the Habsburg monarchy too much exposed to the possibility of receiving the same treatment as its counterpart in Paris. So, Austria's iron-willed chancellor, Clemens von Metternich, brought the shutters down on Europe's most vibrant city. And, allow me a side remark here, but how many times in more recent days has this occurred? Have we not an example of Austria and Hungary closing down their frontiers in today's troubled Europe?
Clemens von Metternich, Austrian State Chancellor, remains infamously known as the arch enemy of the liberal and nationalist forces which had been unleashed by the French Revolution and sown in European hearts and minds by Napoleon. His were strictly reactionary policies, which conditioned the Habsburg Empire's domestic politics and society. With a view to suppressing the forces of change that could potentially threaten to wreck the system from within, he stomped, without any exception, on political activism, demands for freedom of the press and expression, and the need for constitutional representation. For Metternich, these were reflective of a diseased society. He deemed himself the doctor, supplying the antidote to end this distress. Aristocratic power was to be preserved, and the middle and working classes had to be snubbed for continuity to prevail. Strict censorship, state policing, and spy networks became the order of the day. But the disease, he believed, was not only in the Austrian realm. It was contaminating Europe too. In so many ways, he was not any different from the contemporary statesmen and royalists who confronted Napoleon's spread of liberalism and nationalism. What distinguishes him from the rest was the ambition and zeal with which he strove to undo these ills. Convinced that there was a Europe-wide conspiracy threatening to upset the aristocratic and autocratic establishment of the legitimate rulers reigning by divine right, Metternich set in motion the Concert of Europe, with the aim of turning the wheel back to pre-revolutionary Ancien Régime. This system, indeed also known as the Metternich system, devised means and ways of how to snuff revolts whenever and wherever they occurred so as to maintain the balance of power and kill the liberal nationalist germ. True enough, Metternich's iron fist will go a long way in preserving peace in Europe, till at least the Crimean War. However, his system backfired in its failed suppression, which provoked new sentiments and demands. The liberal and nationalist tide was stronger than the total of all his actions, and between continuity and change, the latter would have the upper hand. The turbulent, if progressive, history of 19th century Europe, peppered by the numerous liberal revolts and nationalist uprisings, attests more to Metternich's failure than to his success.
Thank you.
let us continue with our story. Metternich created a network of spies. People were afraid to speak lest their conversations be considered seditious. According to our author, expressing oneself in music was easier. If words are not safe, what is? Asks Suchet. Music, of course. Who can say that a folk band in a tavern, a cafe, or a street corner is fermenting dissent? So Vienna became Europe's capital city of music. Personally, I would add that the rich life of the court, with its formality and theatre life, the rich courtiers who sponsored poor musicians and artists, attracted an endless list of great names in art and music, all of them pulled to the imperial capital like bees to honey. Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven, Schubert, Mendelssohn, Schumann, Wagner, Bruckner, Brahms and Mahler, among so many others. Very few were born in Vienna. Johann Strauss was born and bred there, and he alone, says Suchet, can be said to encapsulate Vienna in his music. The Viennese had this ability of living with danger and intrigue in a frontier city where nothing was stable. Yet they were rich in zest, sounds, rhythm, excitement, laughter, gaiety, and sadness. In the Fledermaus, Johann Strauss says, "Happy is he who is able to forget what he cannot change." Besieged by the Ottomans, invaded by the Grande Armée, ravaged by Napoleon, the Viennese reacted with light-hearted nonchalance. They were accustomed to danger and lived through the Biedermeier era between the Congress of Vienna of 1814 and the life-changing revolutions of 1848 with Gemütlichkeit, a state of mind which is carefree and unworried, accepting of what life may bring. The name Biedermeier came to describe the comfort and safety of your home in a city where talk in public places was dangerous. Thank you.
The Biedermeier period is that period which stretched between the Congress of Vienna in 1815 to 1848, which came to be known as the Year of Revolutions. It was mostly associated with the way and the increasingly influential middle classes lived after the upheavals of the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars. This period is also associated with Austria and Germany, but also includes Scandinavia and coincides with the early Victorian period in Great Britain. With the slow march of the Industrial Revolution, the middle classes were aware of their increasing importance in a world which up to a point was still dominated by the aristocracy. Merchants and bankers, who made the economy flourish, lived more comfortably than before. They also had a better education, and thanks to many of them, the arts flourished, be it music, the visual arts, or literature, or architecture for that matter. They may have lacked the political clout of the future, especially in the domineering position of Metternich's Austria. This German Rhinelander, who became ruler of Austria in all but name, would have liked to turn the clock back and advocated a repressive policing system of an increasingly restless continental Europe. His unholy Holy Alliance and Congress system was meant to deal with troublesome rebellious subjects, or those of other reactionary sovereigns. For many years, the bourgeoisie led a complacent, comfortable existence, with lots of Gemütlichkeit, which is a sort of complacent coziness. In fact, the very name Biedermeier had its origins in a caricature of the comic symbol of middle-class comfort, personified by the fictional Papa Biedermeier. This kind of comfort emphasized family life and private activities. Among the latter was letter writing, so the secretaire was an important item of furniture, as was the piano. There were gatherings with music making and poetry reading. The famous Schubertiads were famous. Society hostesses competed with the aristocratic ones in attracting the best authors, composers, artists, and intellectuals to their salons, which brimmed with talent and excitement. This period was one where Romanticism, which had its roots in the late 18th century, flourished in an amazing manner. A Biedermeier style of furniture became very popular too, as did sartorial fashions, which changed, and certain hairstyles too are unmistakably associated with this period. Interest in books grew, and the activities mentioned above all became subject matter of Biedermeier painting, often very sentimentally treated, be they genre or historical. Schubert, Chopin, Mendelssohn, and early Liszt are typical of this period, as were Donizetti and early Verdi in Austrian-dominated northern Italy. Things were to change, and up to a point were to sweep away the system. The process began quite early. Underneath all that cozy picture of complacent life of most of the middle classes, within whose ranks there were a lot of dissidents, trouble was brewing, not only within the dominant German-speaking states, but also, and this was Austria's great problem, within the subject races. No amount of policing could control secret societies and underground activity, which even attracted certain liberal-minded aristocrats. Nationalism was on the march. In 1820, there were upheavals in Spain and Naples, put down violently in 1823. There was the Second French Revolution in France in 1830, and this triggered off the separation of Belgium from Holland. 1831 saw rebellions breaking out in central Italy and Poland, all brutally crushed, and the stability brought about by repression enabled life to go on almost as before. As usual, it was the middle classes who made revolutions and who were destined to win the day. However, that was to take a very long time. The big outbreak came in 1848. It began in Sicily, continued in France, then Austria, Germany, Bohemia, Hungary, and other parts of Italy. The era of revolutions had arrived, and the Biedermeier interlude was over. Thank you.
The Viennese stayed home or visited friends. For aristocrats and upper classes, this was salon life, a life culturally rich and music. Music was the best form of entertainment, a boon for musicians. Franz Schubert entertained his friends at home with such regularity that the evenings were known as Schubertiads. Johann Strauss the Younger was born in 1825, right in the middle of the Biedermeier period. His music would be the leitmotif of the period. Against the sound of Beethoven's Eroica, with its Napoleonic grandeur, we come to an end of this, the first program of the series A Book, A Thousand Stories, The Last Waltz, when we shall learn about the birth of Strauss Sr. in the dawn of the 19th century, and the full story of this talented family will start to evolve. Till then, you have my greetings. I am grateful to Gerald Fennec, to Simona Zoppardi and Albert Storace, and to the technicians of Campus FM.